Hi, Maureen Dowd, famous Maureen Dowd.
Hi, Tom Ashbrook.
Hi, Jared Sexton, just busting out.
Hi, Tom.
It's great to be here with both of you. Can everybody hear us? I know there was an issue. Is it okay? No? Well, I'm going to speak loudly, and the rest is up to the AV guys, and it's the best I can do. I don't want to blow the eardrums out up here, but I'm talking loud, trust me, and I hope you can hear us. Maureen's very demure, so I don't know if you're going to hear her. But man, it's a rapier demure, isn't it? It's such a pleasure to be here at Boston Book Festival again. This is an incredible event that Boston hosts every year. God bless in this setting, I guess I can say that, Debbie Porter and the gang for getting this thing up off the ground. It's so right for Boston. And to be on the politics panel this year is just about at the whitest, hottest center of everything that you could be. So I'm really happy to be with you two. Introductions. I mean, you know Maureen Dowd. Reading her, it just always blows my mind. It's like this super genius, compared to Jared, kind of up on Olympus, surrounded by all the savviest, smartest, most hooked in people in the country, throwing these thunderbolts down that we all read all the time and gobble up, and her way with words just blows my mind again and again and again, because it's not just a way with words, it's how it cuts to the heart of what's going on. And you all know that, and it's an incredible honor to have you with us today, Maureen. Yeah, yeah. Jared Yates Sexton is a professor at Georgia Southern. I just got back from Georgia last night, so Georgia's on my mind. But he's an Indiana boy, not so far from where I came up. Working class family. Maureen got it. Cops, working class too. But who has she ascended to? Anyway, Jared went out on the road and lived the 2016 campaign in such a visceral way. And if you haven't picked up this book yet, pick it up when we're over. Maureen's as well. If you read all her columns before, read them again, because they bring perspective on the second reading that we just weren't able to have fully on the first. Jared, if she's up on Olympus all wired in, Jared in this campaign was right down in the Hades. Beer halls.
Hades.
In Hades, yes. If you like to call it Hades, you may. He's a real two-fisted kind of Hunter S. Thompson writer, maybe not as nihilistic, but the people's reporter right down in there, two-fisted as in two-fisting. Half the time there's a little bit of drunken reporting in here, but a lot of very clear reporting from the front lines as the whole Trump phenomena was really taking off and emerging, and not many people understood it. And with an Indiana working-class background, he did pretty quickly in his own way. And we're going to hear about that today, and I'm very excited about it. It's a very greedy, gutsy telling of the campaign. I want to read just a little bit from each of them for you. From Jared, just to give a sense of, these are just chapter titles, to give you a sense of where this book goes. Chapter titles about 2016, we all lived through it, you know it, but here, just some of them. The sleep of reason breeds monsters. A nation forever on the brink. My God, do we feel that now. When the devil is at your door, the joke is over. Waiting for the end of the world, anatomy of a car crash, and the title of the book, The People Are Going to Rise Like Waters Upon Your Shore. Watch out, it's a very gritty ride. And if I may, Maureen, just to read from the introduction to Maureen's wonderful book, and you know, if it's the year of voting dangerously, my God, we had no idea. But here she is. When you have lived through extraordinary history, watching a president get impeached, covering father-son presidencies, chronicling a cooked-up war, seeing the wacky woman from Wasilla go rogue, savoring the election of the first commander-in-chief, you don't expect to be exponentially more astonished. True dat, as they say. But then America got mad and went mad. Donald Trump glided down that escalator and promised to build that wall and bragged about his manhood and dissed the Pope and politics, vaulted past parody. It just never ends with Maureen Dowd. It's terrific, and I can't recommend it enough. It's so great to be here with both of you today. Maureen, can we start with you? You give us all these columns, and you put fresh material in here, two interludes, you call them, for perspective. What do you know now, or do we know something now that we didn't know during that year? When you look back on it, what do you, oh goddess who sees all, see now that you or we didn't see then? Or was it all clear?
It's funny when, if you read my interviews during the campaign with Donald Trump now, what's really strange is how little he's changed. Because also, I go back to the 90s with Donald Trump interviewing him. I went on a trip to Miami with him once when he was thinking of running in 2000, and he was just dating Melania, and she was with us. And you know, on this trip to Miami, I said to him, what on earth would make you think you could be president? And he looked at me really sort of surprised, and he goes, well, I get the biggest ratings on Larry King. And then he goes, and do you have any idea how many men have hit on Melania? And how many magazine covers she's been on? And do you know how many times my name is on the General Motors building? And I just realized he had this kind of ego arithmetic where everything was about ratings and size. And, you know, he even has like some fake floors in the Trump Tower because it really doesn't go up that high, but he wants to say it does. And the weird thing was that I guess I shouldn't think this is weird because I've covered enough presidencies to know it brings out, you know, it sort of distills you to your essence. It doesn't really sober and mature you. But so the first thing he does when he's inaugurated is spend his whole inauguration day arguing about the size of the crowd and trying to order the Park Service, you know, not to put out pictures that the crowd was not as big as Obama's. And you guys see yourself. He's tweeting this morning. It's always about, you know, he was saying he wasn't getting enough credit for putting up the for the GDP, gross domestic product going up. And, you know, it's all about ratings and size, which is just a very strange thing for a president to be consumed with.
Donald Trump tweeting this morning about how GDP hit 3%. Mm-hmm. Hasn't been that way in years and years. Of course, he says it's not true. Two consecutive quarters in Obama's second to last term, 3% plus.
Well, he also tweeted this morning that, you know, I did an interview with Jimmy Carter last week in the Times, and Jimmy Carter was saying that Trump had been very unfairly treated by the media because the media had no right to run around and say he was deranged. And so this morning, Trump tweeted, Jimmy Carter defends me from the fake news. Thank you, Mr. President. So we're always just getting, you know, we're getting distilled through Trump's id.
Peas in a pod, Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump, maybe not. Maybe not. No. The Times talked with the president famously not long after his election last year. He told Arthur Sulzberger in that interview, the publisher, you can call me anytime, Arthur, but quoting you here, the only one who can't call me is Maureen. She treats me too rough.
Well, I've talked to... Yeah, he tweeted that I was a wacky neurotic dope, which kind of hurt my feelings because that's what he always tweets about women. I wanted a customized insult.
Just wait.
Yeah, but he came to, he called us and he came over for his first meeting at the Times. And, you know, he said, Maureen can't talk to me. And the publisher said, well, as we say about Maureen, it's not your fault. It's just your turn.
I want to go right in the trenches with Jared, but give us one more piece because you've talked with him. You talked with him for years. You know him from New York and beyond. What's it like when you're, I assume you've sat this close with Donald Trump, or closer, God help you, but what's it like?
Well, what surprised me is that he went to the dark side and he sort of never even tried to come back. And when I was asking, you know, Steve Bannon about this, I said, why hasn't he tried to, you know, be more bipartisan or likable? He was a Democrat. He gave to Hillary. He used to play golf with Bill. And Steve Bannon goes, that's not what we want. That's what, you know, Jared and Ivanka want. Like, Steve Bannon wants him dark and hungry. But I asked him once during the campaign, why are you going to these dark places? You're urging violence against journalists at rallies, and this does not seem like the person I covered for 30 years. And he paused, and I think he really tried to answer. He said, I got to number one saying these things, and I want to stay at number one. So it's pretty much as simple as that.
Dark and hungry brings us to you, Jared. What did you find? Explain to us what you were doing out there in the trenches, first of all. Everybody knows what Maureen, but you were sort of the insurgent, kind of the lone scout out there in many ways on your own. You were driving yourself. You were buying the six packs and headed back to crappy motels at night. What were you doing, and what did you find that ended up leaving you with death threats and weird, wacky, dangerous strangers in your front yard?
Yeah, I did not set out to cover this campaign. I was actually writing a novel at the time, and it failed really badly.
You sure got sidetracked, man. This is amazing stuff.
Yeah, it was planned out to be about 400 pages, and I got to 550, and it wasn't going anywhere.
So, on the novel.
Oh, it was awful. So I decided to do this thing.
You can't
on the
beat
side.
The story we're telling here, so I'm sorry.
I'm very fortunate that it fell apart. But I started going out to all these rallies, and I just wanted to see what was happening in the campaign. And after reading Maureen's book, I think like her, I was expecting sort of a dull campaign. I expected Hillary Clinton
from Donald Trump. You expected dull?
I expected Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush,
mm-hmm.
And I thought the whole thing was going to be a little bit boring. So I thought I would throw myself into it, go to some rallies, see what was happening. And I started going to Trump rallies, and I started going into the crowds, and I started noticing that there was a really ugly energy that was building up among the Trump movement. We had a lot of people who were angry. We had a lot of people who were fighting back against political correctness. And in essence, the people who supported Trump at these rallies, his most fervent supporters of his base, I think they started feeding off of each other, and they started saying all these like terribly misogynistic, racist things. And I started reporting on that, and I think at the time that unfortunately some of the networks and things like that, they were pointing the camera at Trump on stage and
yeah.
were hitting record, and they weren't going into the crowds and really talking to people. And that's what was growing at the heart of it, and I got very concerned about it.
Jared, come on, man. Take us there. It's all in here. Really ugly. Fighting PC. Give us the stuff. You were in the middle of it. Give us the viscera. I mean, you were kind of there first and writing about it loudly, not for the biggest outlets, but take us there.
Well, the first night that I became very concerned about the Trump campaign was December 7th, 2015. And that was actually the night that he proposed his Muslim immigration ban. And this was aboard the USS Yorktown. And I started seeing a lot
Yorktown.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I started seeing a lot of anger building up in this crowd aboard this aircraft carrier. And then they went outside. And I had noticed that Trump could take them up to a certain line, mm-hmm. right? He could insinuate these things. He could dog whistle these things. But the moment they left his rallies, they would say it their own, right? The slurs would come out. The hateful speech would come out. And then they went outside and they clashed with protesters. And they started threatening their lives. They started threatening to go back and get guns and shoot these people and run them over with their trucks, which unfortunately I think was a terrible like precursor to what happened in Charlottesville.
What were you hearing there? That, I mean, you weren't naive. You weren't born yesterday. You weren't born with a silver spoon. But still, your hair stood up on end. What was it?
Well, unfortunately, and this is one of the reasons I think I was able to understand the Trump movement, the base particularly, I come from a working class family in Indiana. And what I actually heard, and this is what frightened me the most, was I was hearing these people say the things that my family said behind closed doors. The type of thing that these people should have been afraid to say in public for fear of consequence. And so I started hearing these things, and then on top of it, these authoritarian, fascistic things started coming out where they were talking about, you know, killing everybody, taking guns and turrets and mowing down protesters. I mean, it was very, very ugly stuff.
And it wasn't just saying. I mean, they would print this stuff right on the T-shirts. We later would see it in Cleveland. I saw it there. I'm sure you did too. Hillary sucks, but not like Monica. Mm-hmm. Trump that bitch. I mean, and the stuff you report out of the, and you reported it, mm-hmm. and what happened? I mean, we're talking June 2016.
Yeah.
And you've got It's at your doorstep.
Well, so I went into that rally, and I was doing this for like a small literary journal at the time.
Atticus? Was that the?
Atticus Review. Yep. And when I went into this rally, I had like 1,000 Twitter followers. And after I live tweeted the rally, I went outside, and I had 80,000. And yeah, the internet's weird. So immediately, I was kind of thrown into the middle of this conversation because suddenly people started carrying these accounts, and they started talking about what was going on inside of Trump rallies and the movement. And almost immediately, people started coming after me for my job, my professorship.
At Georgia Southern.
At Georgia Southern. And then all of a sudden, I got the attention of the alt-right, and I started getting the harassment there. And then the white supremacists showed up, and they started showing up to my house. They tried to break into my house. I've received threatening phone calls and emails ever since.
You write, under Bannon's guidance, maybe some of the genesis of this, Breitbart turned into a one-stop destination for disgruntled people like my family, Jared Sexton writes. There, they were sold a reality that confirmed their darkest suspicions, talking about dark and hungry, about how the world really worked, while also receiving assurance that progressivism had been out to get them. When social justice advocates demanded they check their privilege, my dirt-poor white family looked and saw no privilege to check.
Yeah, there was a narrative going on in my family, and this goes back, I mean, to when I was a child in the 1980s. Because they are poor and because they've been disadvantaged, they're very conspiratorial, right? These are people who talk about UN takeovers, talk about the New World Order. And what they heard from Trump, and especially from Bannon when he came onto the campaign, is that narrative got focused and concentrated, and they started speaking in the same language. It started becoming this global threat, right? And so at that point, like all of these terrible suspicions that they had and these worst instincts, I think Bannon spoke directly to them.
When Trump was introduced, you watched, this is in Cleveland at the Republican convention, I watched you write as a pair of supporters in the crowd raised their arms multiple times in an unabashed Nazi salute, and your first death threat came on Twitter from a Twitter user named Warrior Queen, the handle at Supagoy88. Who was that?
That is a white supremacist. And I really got the attention of them. And I live in southeastern Georgia, so unfortunately I'm surrounded by white supremacists and KKK and neo-Nazis. But I started noticing that they were everywhere. At every Trump rally, you would run across these people, separatists, white supremacists, KKK. And like they really came after anybody who reported on what was going on in terms of emboldening that.
Maureen, from your perch, as you were watching, and again, blowing our minds every week and more, did you see this mounting? When did you begin, to your mind now, to see the outlines of what was rising here?
Well, I come from a family that all voted for Trump, so all of my fellow columnists were taking these road trips, and they would say, we need to go find this strange creature called the Trump voter and reason with them, and they would somehow all end up at this one cafe in Paris, Kentucky.
And, somehow.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would just have to go home and hear it.
You remind us that Thanksgiving last year, yeah, there was Trump champagne when you went home.
I
and
know.
Your brother Kevin calls Hillary Cersei, as in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, he was. He called me as I was getting on the plane here, and he said, you know, like I usually let him write the Thanksgiving column and to bring New York Times readers into the belly of the red beast. And he goes, well, I've got another offer from Irish Central to write about Trump's first year, but I think I'm going to go with you because you've got a bigger readership. And my public is waiting for the call.
Oh, my public.
He's like kind of the Ernest Hemingway of the right. But he, but you know, it was funny because I went to a rally in Mississippi to try to find, you know, what Jared has written about so wonderfully. And I interviewed a bunch of people, and all I found were really sad people working three jobs who felt they had been left behind by both parties. So I think part of this thing was obviously racism and sexism and the last shriek of white male privilege, but part of it was that all of these people like President Obama and people who were moving on to this shiny new world of globalization you know, had just sort of forgotten about a lot of people and how to, you know, bring them along. And Trump captured that. It's funny because, you know, I walked by Trump Tower the other day and he's on the most ritzy block in the world. And yet he himself, because of whatever wounds he has, you know, has all this aggrievement. We've been robbed, you know, things were rigged, and somehow that connected with a completely different class of people. It's a really amazing phenomenon.
Jared, take us to the Democratic Party side of what you saw, because it wasn't just Trump rallies that you went to. The title of your book, The People Are Going to Rise Like the Waters Upon Your Shore, is not from a Trump rally. It's from, and it's against Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I think this was one of the more underreported stories, actually, of the 2016 campaign. There were riots outside the Democratic National Convention, and these were Bernie supporters. These were people far left who eventually, when talking to them, I got told there was no difference between Clinton and Trump. And they, I would be told that they were actually going to vote for Trump as a way to punish the DNC. I mean, it got very, very ugly. And I mean, there was a rage, I think, and this comes, I think, from a general antipathy towards the political process. I think there are people, obviously, as you're talking about, who Trump sort of connects with, who it doesn't matter that he's a billionaire, that he doesn't come through on these promises to them. I think it's just having that weapon against the system. And for these people at this rally and at the convention, I think they were looking for any way they could to burn this whole thing down.
My nephew, Robbie, was a Sanders supporter. Mm-hmm. He works outside Chicago in a supermarket chain as a manager. That chain has been bought and sold by private equity firms. And every time he's seen wages go down, he's seen staffing shrunk, demands on the workers go up until he feels treated like a slave and forced to treat his employees like even more like slaves. He's furious. I mean, he cannot stand Hillary Clinton. And though he was for Sanders, I really wonder, I don't know which way he would, he's probably still Sanders, but Trump still talks that game. How's your brother Kevin with Trump now, after almost a year?
Yeah, he's saving his thoughts for his column.
Of course, but the Ernest Hemingway of the Trump.
Yeah, in just two more weeks. here's the thing, my family are not like the voters that Jared talked to. My family are classic Republican. If I say country club, it's going to sound too ritzy. They're like cheap Catholic country clubs and in the D.C. suburbs. And basically, there were three things they wanted out of this election. They did not want another President Clinton. They did want Republicans on the Supreme Court, and they did want less regulation. And so they're quite content. You know, they don't get caught up in all the daily analysis of whether Trump's crazy or whether, you know, he's destroying democracy and trashing the planet. You know, they got Gorsuch.
Little crap like that.
They got Gorsuch. They don't have Hillary. And, you know, they feel like content, as far as I know.
I don't know if you know, Jared, I don't know if you're in touch, but how do you think Bob Corker's comments land when he says he's debasing the nation? Jeff Flake last week, reckless, dangerous to democracy. How does that land on the people who were just furious or sad in the Trump rallies?
Well, unfortunately, I think that politics, and I talk to students all the time, and I say there's a difference between politics, which is how we agree or disagree on how to move the country forward and fix problems. There's a difference between that and the game of politics that we play, which at the end of the night, it's like a scoreboard, right? One party wins or one party loses. The people who are so angry at the system, I think they've learned how to tune out that. And I don't think that they might even have heard what Corker has said or what Flake has said. And I think that they get their information straight from Donald Trump's Twitter account. I think he's inoculated a lot of these people to paying attention to what he says as opposed to like what the coverage is.
And you, I think it was you. I read so much of the two of you in the last few days that I get mixed up about who. So I think it was you saying the rough language, the vulgarity, the crudeness, the coarseness, not a problem.
No, my family are factory workers, mine workers, prison guards. In fact, when they were told that Donald Trump's abusive language, his misogyny, all of these things were reasons to vote against him, they heard that they couldn't be president, right? They got told that he can't be president because he behaves this way, and I think it told them, like, that they're not worthy of the office, and I think it backfired in a lot of places.
You quote John Meacham in here, the wonderful historian, Maureen, saying it's as though Trump blew up the science lab, exposing the raw nerve of America's stream of consciousness. What happened? What happened? Because it wasn't really classic Republicans who elected him in the end. The margin that elected him was this crowd.
Yeah. There was, you know, President Obama and Hillary Clinton just kind of ignored all the signs right in front of their eyes that there was this you know, anger building, and you could see it in the Sanders rallies if they had not been so busy rigging the system and suppressing the excitement about Sanders. But I don't know, you know, I just think that Trump, you know, there was a movement, Trump latched onto it. His aggrievement matched their aggrievement, and that was it. He rode the wave. And, you know, even Trump was shocked that he got elected. Like, at 6 o'clock election day, he told Hope Hicks, you know, well, the only thing I'm going to miss is the motorcade. You know, his campaign was ridiculous. And so I think everyone was really shocked. We certainly at the Times were not well prepared for it.
You and a couple of other people, and you write, Jared, on this theme of the president, and which is part of what Flake's talking about, and Corker's, but you say, but you're talking about Democrats, in criticizing his behavior and language, not small things for a now president, but you say the Democrats were giving cover for the blue-collar billionaire persona the Trump campaign had created. He was rude and crass and spoke his mind, all of these being things his supporters cited outside his rallies as being draws. Because he was boorish and tactless, they saw him as one of their own. Clinton played directly into that characterization by tossing Trump supporters into the same basket of deplorables right along with him, and they became his voters.
Yeah, I actually, looking back, I think 20 or 30 years ago, I think the Democratic Party would have ran against Trump as being a billionaire, right? It would have been talk about he's the person who outsources these jobs. He's the person that has a plane with his name on it or a building with his name on it. I think that would have been the strategy. And I think in these old strongholds that the Democrats have started to lose, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, even Indiana, I think that these were states that probably could have benefited from a message like that.
Were they running against him on his manners because they were now near billionaires too, because they were charging $500,000 per speech and raising megabucks?
Well, yeah, a lot of Trump's flaws were sort of canceled out by lesser versions of those flaws in Hillary. But, you know, I forgot I was going to tell you guys a story that Bill Clinton, you know, went to. This is a weird sort of footnote about American history, that two Democrats have won the popular vote and not gotten to serve as president because they didn't listen to Bill Clinton. First, Gore was not speaking to him because of Monica. So when Bill said, I want to go campaign in the South for you in Arkansas and Tennessee and stuff, Gore didn't let him. And then he told Hillary, like, I think a year out, that there was something wrong with the group of voters that was his lifetime specialty, right? White rural men. He said, I'm just uneasy. There's a problem. Let me go campaign for you. And Robbie Mook, Hillary's campaign manager, literally would go around to reporters and imitate Bill Clinton in a Southern accent, making this suggestion.
Mockingly,
as though in the world of big data, and they had all their data from the Obama campaign, this was so ridiculous to, you know, and he would do it in Clinton's voice. And, you know, that's just a sign of dysfunction. If you've got the world's living expert on white rural men on your campaign and he tells you there's a problem, just let him go deal with it, you know? Just very strange.
We're going to take your questions. There are microphones. In about 15 minutes, we'll take 10 or 15 minutes at the end of this time. So if you have them in mind. Here we are in Boston, and it is maybe the bluest state in the country, and it is doing extraordinarily well right now, and the globalizing period, by and large, not for everybody by any means, but by and large, did very well for Boston, and Bostonians voted that way. You were on the trail. If you want to speak to a crowd in that city, and I don't mean to portray the politics of everyone in this audience, I'm sure it's diverse, but to speak to this general population who may have been mystified, and even now, just smacking their foreheads in disbelief or unwillingness to believe or confused about what's happening, what do you have to say to this audience, this city with its politics?
This is one of those situations. I think we're sitting here talking about how you said the New York Times was surprised by Trump. I was as well. And one of the reasons was...
Even you, who live in Statesboro, Georgia.
I was because...
Who was at the rallies.
Because when I started reporting, I started to get brought in into the media complex, right? I would start talking to analysts and pundits, and I started having conversations about the election with them as opposed to my family, who were making their own Trump shirts, who were making their own Trump hats and signs.
Wow.
Which, by the way, I think is one of those things that we kind of lost track of because everyone's like, oh, the campaign's a joke. They can't even get yard signs out to people. They can't even get shirts to people.
Oh, they did. I saw them all over Ohio.
Right. And eventually, the people who couldn't do it, they made their own, right? But then I would talk to all of these other people, and I'm a professor, and I'm in a liberal arts college, and so I have a lot of friends and colleagues.
You don't write like a professor. You write like Hunter S. Thompson. What's going on here?
Thank you. But yeah, so I have all these colleagues who would say, who are these Trump voters? I don't know any. Right? And so we've been so siloed, and we have so many echo chambers that we don't even understand that there is a part of the country. I had a conversation with a person at a Trump event who told me that he thought 10% of the country was liberal and 90% conservative, which is just such a wild misunderstanding of everything. But the life that he lived, he was saying he didn't know any liberals, and he had no idea that they were out there. So I think that it's a real problem in modern society that we don't even really know the other side.
If you think about that iconic Boston audience, Maureen, what do you think it needs to get to understand what's happened and what's happening? And again, I don't want to stereotype, but here we are in Boston, and Boston didn't elect Donald Trump.
Well, I don't know. I think that the Democrats have had kind of a history of nominating hall monitor types and just saying, eat your spinach. This is who we're giving you, and you're going to like it. You know, I think... We're not talking the elan and charm of JFK here. So, you know, I just think until they learn that voters have to be wooed and won with a certain amount of, you know, personality and charm, that's what politics is all about and always has been. You know, if it's just do this, we've decided it for you, they're not really going to succeed, and identity politics are just getting more and more fractured.
Do you see a fire-breathing seducer, potential candidate who could break through to that audience now on the Democratic side?
Well,
if that's what it, if
the
that's
problem
what it
is that the Clintons were the party of the Clintons, and President Obama was the party of Obama, and neither of, or all three of them did not pay that much attention to bringing up, you know, a farm team. So when President Obama was asked, that's supposed to be his job now, developing, you know, Democratic candidates to help with the party he sort of decimated. But, you know, there are a lot of really appealing people in the Democratic Party, but they have been suffocated. Nobody brought them up and said, here are our future stars. And so that's a real problem, too, because they don't have, like Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado is very appealing, and Senator Heinrich and Amy Klobuchar. And Michael Bennett, you know, is trying to be on TV more. He's trying to develop a national persona. But all this should have been done a long time ago. They should have been grooming their stars.
Well, you were at the Democrats' rallies, Clinton rallies, Sanders rallies. You saw the near or riots outside the Philadelphia convention. What do you see in the Democratic Party now? We talk a lot about the Republican Civil War. What about the Democratic side of the ledger?
Well, I would just say that the rallies that I would go to, particularly Clinton rallies that like gained steam and gained momentum, was when Elizabeth Warren was on the stage. She seemed to revel fighting with Trump. And I mean, I actually think that if she might have been VP, I think we might have had just a back alley brawl between the two of them that might have neutralized a lot of Trump's talents and appeal.
Would she pull Trump voters over?
That's a question, right? Because a lot of it's economic populism, right? It's standing up for people who are vulnerable.
But Trump that bitch is a T-shirt that could be pointed in a lot of directions.
Well, that's exactly right. And I actually think with the Democrats, we're still fighting over primaries. Right, we're still having fights right now about Clinton versus
what?
Sanders, and I think in the face of Trump, who I think is an existential threat, I'm just shocked almost every day that it can't be some sort of a rallying point, that this is something that needs to be taken on with a united front, but it just continues.
Let's go wider. Jimmy Carter, you sat with him. What does he want? He's 93. Does he really want to go to North Korea? Is this about Jimmy Carter wanting one last star turn or to save the planet? He did it once before, kind of, for a little while with Korea. Or what is it?
Well, Jimmy,
you were down in Athens, right, with him?
Jimmy Carter is, I think, appropriately... I wouldn't use the word hurt, because that wouldn't be the right word, but feels that President Clinton and President Obama did not really respect him. Obama never returned his phone calls. He said, talk to Hillary or something. And so...
Michelle had a first lady's launch on mental health and didn't invite Rosalind?
And didn't invite
her
Rosalind,
main theme?
Which was her issue for her whole life. It's just... So, but I noticed, 40... or even 50 minutes into the interview, that he wasn't saying anything harsh about Trump, who is his polar opposite. No matter what I asked about, like Trump having the evangelicals, and was there hypocrisy there, and, Jared running Middle East, no matter what I asked the press, he would answer in this kind of positive way about Trump. And so with 10 minutes to go, it suddenly struck me, oh my gosh, he wants Trump to send him to North Korea. And so then I asked him, and sure enough, that's what he wanted. And he's cagey enough to know that if he gave Trump a compliment, like the press aren't fair to you, which Trump tweeted about this morning, that, he might have a shot, which would be good for the world. Jimmy Carter cares more about saving the world than he does about being humiliated. When Trump used to tweet he was the worst president or the next worst next to Obama. So... he doesn't care. He's a very strong, pious person, and he thinks the North Korean situation is so dangerous, and so does General Mattis, that he's willing to suck all that up and, just get out there and save the world.
He's got JC on his belt buckle.
Oh, yeah.
Does it stand for Jimmy Carter or Jesus Christ?
Yeah. Jimmy Carter. But, yeah, I was there with some of his former White House aides, and I think he was a very tough president to work for, very starchy. But you've got to give him credit in a lot of ways. He sticks to his principles, and he and Rosalind were holding hands for most of the day I was there. So, no ethical shadows there. He runs the Carter Center. You never hear any of the ethical things that you do with the Clinton Foundation.
I want to talk ethical and men. I want to talk about that before we're finished here. I want to ask you this. The vice president has just been out at the nuclear silos. General Mattis has been on the DMZ, 16 inches from the line. Do you feel the United States, its military moving toward, or are we on a war footing?
I think that General Mattis thinks North Korea's very, very dangerous. And, when Nixon was president and he was sort of starting to get drunk and devolving and talking to the paintings in the White House, Kissinger and Schlesinger arranged a pact where, with the military, where if Nixon, he began talking about all the people he could kill in a nuclear war. And so they arranged a pact where if he ever did call the military about anything nuclear, they would call Schlesinger and Kissinger. So I don't think the generals around Trump have gone that far, but it is kind of funny because in the in the 50s and 60s, the ultimate fear, which you saw in movies like 7 Days in May, was that the generals would have a coup and take over the presidency. And now it's kind of like, can't the generals have a coup and take over the presidency?
But that was on the presumption that the generals were more sober. And in the last couple of weeks, there have been questions raised about that with General Kelly, who is at the president's
right
elbow.
Right.
So if the generals took over, are you sure they wouldn't, with their own rationale, maybe a little less id-driven but more testosterone, I don't know what, driven, do the same thing?
Yeah, the General Kelly thing was very sad to watch because Trump does create all these crazy, I wouldn't even call them diversions because I think they're the main event for him, but these crazy sort of controversies that wouldn't exist if he wasn't stirring them up. And it was hard to see him drag General Kelly down to his own level. But I was checking into a hotel in New York recently, and the guy at the front desk tried to engage me in a fight about the NFL kneeling thing. And I'm like, I don't want to get into any of Trump's crazy fights when I'm checking into a hotel. But it's created this, I always say that Trump is kind of the Rosemary's Baby of social media, reality TV, and politics. And it's, there are good things about it. It's boy journalism and feminism and liberalism and the ACLU and bars and shrinks. But it's also created this, constant tension. You should see our White House reporters. They're dragging around. They're so exhausted. Because you can't press your browser fast enough to refresh with this guy.
Rosemary's Baby in Bob Corker's adult daycare center. What an image here. Jared, in a nightmare scenario, because you spend a lot of time with people, if it somehow, please God, let it not be. Send Jimmy Carter, do anything. But if it were war, and this would not be like Iraq, this would not be like Afghanistan, Lord knows the ferocity, the death toll, the people who voted for Trump, are they willing to go into that meat grinder?
They think they are.
After all the guys who went to, the sandbox?
Unfortunately.
After all the guys still in Afghanistan?
Unfortunately, I can tell you, post 9/11, the same people who now support Trump, these are the people with a lot of authoritarian instincts, right? These are people who say, after 9/11, we should have nuked the entire Middle East. Men, women, and children, kill them all. That's what they're saying now about North Korea. It's not a lot of concern about the consequences of
it. But it's not as clean as nukes. I have an uncle who lost his leg in the Korean War. It was hard to farm with one leg, with a wooden leg. I mean, it would be men and women. I've got a close friend who's on an aircraft carrier out there right now, and
I think there's a lack of empathy there and a lack of understanding of that consequence.
But they went to war. I don't get that.
Like,
their sons are the ones, I'm guessing, mm-hmm. who've gone to war now for 25 years.
But it's the same thing with Trump. I mean, when he gets on Twitter and escalates a feud with, the leader of North Korea, I don't think there's a lot of thought about consequence. I think some of these people want to jump in with both feet and figure it out later, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Maureen, what's the way out of this weird patch we're in? Do you see it?
I'm not sure. I don't think anyone knows where this is leading, and that's what's so scary about it. Because either, I interviewed Mark Cuban the other day, which is this Sunday column. Either we're going to go to cut through all the cacophony of Twitter and everything. We're going to keep going for these larger-than-life celebrities, who seem like outsiders, who can be the Rottweiler to, bite the system and tear it apart.
You mean as presidents? We're going to have a series of...
Yeah, I'm saying, some people like Howard Feynman think it might open the door to a lot more of these celebrities because... the media certainly, Mark Cuban has this great phrase, headline porn, where he says the media are kind of complicit because they want the headline porn. And certainly it's been financially remunerate. How do you say that
word? We all know what you mean.
Yeah, that word.
Nobody can say it.
Yeah, for us. And, you know, so somehow I feel like, you know, Trump's biographer, Michael D'Antonio, said that Trump is an attention addict, and right now he has a heroin needle stuck up his arm because he's in the center of where he can get the most attention in the world. And I feel like the media are addicts now, too, of Trump. So we're in this kind of weird, twisted, toxic relationship. Narcissus, and we're the mirror, or, you know, the selfie stick for him.
Wow. Listen to that. Just print it. Columns ready. Incredible. Out it comes. Ready for questions. And while you gather at microphones, if you have questions to put to Maureen Dowd and Jared Yates Sexton, let me read just from the end a couple of things from Jared's book. I'm going to ask you a question about one. Your questions in a moment. You write, though critics will harshly criticize the working poor as uneducated and ignorant, there is at least one thing they're exceptionally talented at, detecting bullshit when a rich person is trying to manipulate them. Really?
Usually. I think Donald Trump is the one exception. It has to do with those mannerisms.
Kind of a big
right?
exception.
It's eating the fast food. It's being vulgar. It's being offensive. And I think he came in under the wire. And that's exactly why I think the Democrats missed the train on how to beat him. I think it was by pointing out his wealth and his influence.
You're right. Trump's entire blue-collar billionaire persona was fragile and could have been effectively dismantled had the Democrats even tried. And let me read one more paragraph. Clinton's strategy drove them, Trump voters, further into Trump's camp. And with the aid of Steve Bannon's populist rhetoric, he positioned himself as the voice of the common man. He was lying, Jared writes. And I suspect deep down in their guts, his supporters knew as much. If only they'd been given half a reason, the portion of Trump's working class base that gave him the presidency would have evaporated, and all the lies, exaggerations, internet manipulations, and cognitive dissonance in the world wouldn't have saved his candidacy. I'm not sure, but it's pretty good reading. Question?
I must say I was favorably impressed by the fact that white women as a group went for Trump. Maureen Dowd, do you rack that up to perhaps some weird form of misogyny or to the repulsive nature of the candidate on the other side? And speaking of hatred, there's plenty of hatred coming from the left, of course. We see this in the desire to see him dead and all manner of things I can't repeat here. But suppose that Trump died of a heart attack tomorrow or assassinated. Would you look upon that favorably or not?
Would you what?
Look upon that favorably or not?
That's a horrible, Thank you. Horrible question.
That's a pretty horrible question, but there it is. That's, it is a horrible question.
But the first part of your question
White
I'll answer.
For
that
Trump.
Was fine. When I first started covering politics, I covered Geraldine Ferraro, and I had to do a magazine piece on the historic phenomenon of Ferraro. So I called, you know, dozens of women across the country that the New York Times had polled and talked to them. And I was really sort of dumbfounded that, you know, Las Vegas waitresses and all these, you know, Michigan housewives and all these different kinds of women outside of the New York media bubble, you know, were not that excited about voting for a woman. And they, you know, one woman said, well, why should she have anything that I don't have? And I don't think a woman can handle it. And so I think the idea that women are going to vote for women the way African Americans vote for an African American just doesn't really wash. I mean, women tend to vote a lot on national security, and if they think somebody's going to be stronger, it's the Naomi Wolf, when she was advising Al Gore, called it the good father syndrome, you know, the father, or could be the mother, who's going to protect the house from invaders, and, you know, the house being the country and their house. So women just, I don't think, they keep trying to act like women and African Americans vote the same, and I don't think they do.
Jared, did you see Donald Trump positioning himself as the good father on the campaign trail?
Absolutely, and I think there was another piece of motivation.
You did?
Happening. Oh, yeah.
In what way, for the audience, is there? Because he could look like the dangerous, wacky father, too, if you wanted to look at it that way, and it wouldn't be hard.
Well, I mean, I wrote about this in the New York Times. I think he displayed a toxic masculinity that a lot of these women were very familiar with.
But that's a good father?
I don't know if it's the good. I put quotes around good. But I think that Trump was basically reminding a lot of people, especially in these blue-collar families, of the people in their families. They heard him say the same things that their brothers and their husbands and their dads would say. And I think there's a lot of cognitive dissonance that goes along with that and the inherent misogyny of it.
Question.
Thanks. Yeah, one thing that I think has been drastically underestimated in this election and even, you know, decades prior is the influence of right-wing media and the ecosystem that they've created, Fox, Drudge, National Review, Daily Wire, etc. And I think they've controlled a lot of the public discourse. You know, there's been a lot of reaction this week to the, you know, the Uranium One scandal, the Steele dossier funding scandal. How can we in the media push back against that without becoming purely reactionary and in giving them power and giving that narrative power?
That is a fantastic question. I wrestle with that. Let me go over to you first on that one, Jared. At some point in the book, you write that the remote control may be the most important piece of technology in history politically.
Yeah, I mean, there's a ready-made narrative that's there, right? And the right-wing media has pushed this since there was a mass media to push. I mean, the great lie that's always there, and that we're under constant attack. The country's going to fall apart if we don't push Republicans who are strong and you know, push this racist point of view. How do you beat that? I think that people ultimately are suspicious of it. They need an alternative. And
they're suspicious of partisan media?
I actually think that people who watch Fox News, you know, they'll sit there and they'll say that it's the only real news. But when it comes up and says fair and balanced, they'll roll their eyes with everybody else. I think they know it. And I think if they're given an alternative, I think they'll take it. But I think that's one of the reasons the Democrats need to, like, step up their messaging.
They have an alternative. Yeah. I mean, as you, with your remote control, your point was hit this button and you've got one view of the world. Hit this button and it's a completely different world. Choose your reality. Choose your adventure. They have alternatives now.
They do, but they don't yet have a reason to go to them. I mean, you have to break a huge cognitive dissonance, right?
Like, no, I don't know what you mean.
Well, okay, so if somebody believes that this lie, right? If somebody believes that lie, they pattern their entire life around it, and everything that comes across then challenges that idea.
Mm-hmm.
They have to make a decision. Have they believed a lie for a very long time, and that's part of their identity? Do they toss it out and start a new identity, or do they add on? Right, with this uranium story, I think it's something that can add to their worldview, even though it's patently false. And I think that's one of the largest things that we're fighting now, is we can tailor our own reality, you know, one news story at a time. I think that's, like, really potent.
Maureen, partisan media, right-wing media, what about that going forward? And the question is, how do you fight it or resist it or break out of it without succumbing to becoming it one way or another?
I don't know. You know, it was an amazing phenomenon to watch Donald Trump rising despite tales of him being a sexual predator, even as Roger Ailes, his enabler, was falling for being a sexual predator. It was just a very strange moment in American history. But I think Trump, in a weird way, has sort of weakened Fox when he took on Megyn Kelly in the debate. You know, I don't feel like... there was a funny tweet that came over this morning that Fox has spent... somebody counted up the airtime, and it was like 25 hours covering Harvey Weinstein, who was a big Democratic donor, and like 12 minutes covering Bill O'Reilly. But I think...
Shocked.
Yeah, I do not think Fox is the powerhouse it once was, even under a president who goes on Fox and Friends.
Next question. Thank you.
First, I want to thank you for coming into Boston and welcome you to our city. I'm Alyssa. I'm a graduate student in anthropology at Brandeis University. And I think
it's my hometown, Alyssa. I work right up the street. Love Boston. Thank you. Anyway, yeah.
And there's one group I think that was ignored throughout a lot of the conversation, and that's the voting patterns of Black women and also their economic experiences. They have 400 times less wealth than white women and white men.
Could you repeat that? What was that?
They have 400 times less wealth.
400 times less wealth, yes.
Yes, yeah, which means that white men, white women have 400 more times. So black women in the 2016 election, 94-96% voted for Clinton, whereas 53% of white women voted for Trump. And so a lot of the conversation has been, well, you know, white people, white rural people, they're so frustrated economically. I don't really buy that. And so I was just wondering how you guys reconcile this idea of the white working class versus the voting patterns of black people. You know, because I think that there's a lot of, I think we're ignoring a lot of the motivations that racism gives white people.
Did you compare what proportion of the African-American women vote Obama got versus Hillary, perchance?
I mean, my question is about the 2016 election.
And no, I just wondered. I was just curious.
You can't get much higher than 96%. You can get a little higher, but
yeah,
that's pretty high. For
my question is really, how do you reconcile the motivations of race? Because if it was really about economic disparity, you would think black women would have voted for Trump.
Well, I'll say first of all that I'm active on Twitter, and black female Twitter was all over the Trump situation, and they told people left and right that they thought that white women were going to go for Trump. That was like an early thing. I absolutely agree that race is a factor. So, for instance, with my family, when I'm talking about these economic problems, racism absolutely plays into it, and those things have been there for the longest time, and I actually think that the Trump campaign masterfully played those really terrible instincts. I think it was a big part of it.
Maureen, what about race versus economics as the real motivation here? Race, racism.
Yeah, I think they were both motivations in the election. I do. And it's a very interesting point you're raising.
I mean, I was in Atlanta yesterday with a professor at Morehouse College who's all about the black middle class. Her husband is a minister who he's also African-American, who voted for Trump. I asked her about it. She didn't want to talk about it on the air. A kind of faux pas, but we can't get deeper than that right here, but thank you for your question. Next, please. Thank you.
Thank you for a very engaging conversation. While I share your perspectives, I think it would have also been interesting to have a prominent right-wing or Republican journalist, too, to share what, you know.
Well, we got two books in 1 hour, but okay.
Fair. But my question is, the conversation we're having today obviously is somewhat dire. I mean, I think I'm very concerned, as you all are, about the state of the country. But I wonder what kind of conversation we would be having now had Hillary Clinton chosen Bernie Sanders as her VP, and what your insights are on that. You don't read much about it, but I wonder what would have happened had she done that.
Well, to me, that's part of the pattern of arrogance that caused her to lose. You know, I just think JFK did not want Lyndon Johnson, but he felt he needed that extra edge. And with the Clinton campaign, you know, she met with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, but she never really considered running with them. And I think what was missing from her campaign was that excitement and passion. And if she had chosen Warren or Sanders, or maybe I'm completely wrong. I think if Hillary and Warren had won together, they would have won.
Jared, do you think, Hillary and Warren, do you think that if Bernie Sanders had been out there, some of those Trump voters would have responded, next to Hillary, would have responded to his thundering populism and come over, or?
Yeah, I think that would have preserved a good bit of the Democratic vote. But I also think that this alternative history that we're talking about,
yeah,
like look at Trump now. He's in three feuds. He's feuding with the country, he's feuding with liberals, and he's feuding with the Republican Party. I think in this alternative history, we could very well see infighting between Clinton and Sanders. And I think we'd be looking at the Democratic Party splintering a lot the same way we're watching the Republicans.
We got time for one more. Yes, ma'am.
I 100% agree that if Bernie had been her running mate, I spent a lot of time on the ground in New Hampshire. There were a lot of voters, traditional white male Republican voters, who were very enthused by Bernie. He won by a lot. But that said, after the election, I did a lot of soul searching. I was working, and I kept thinking somehow somebody paid somebody off because, and I keep looking at this
for what?
Thing, for the result. Because
what do you mean
39
for the
states the Russians tried to hack, and they weren't successful in one of them, five of them. So where is the investigation now with Bob Mueller? Where is the smoking gun going to be? And why isn't the media, didn't they report more on that? Because, you know, I'm looking at, like, people in New Hampshire like Dante Scala, and, you know, they're looking at, you know, exit poll results and how skewed they are and all kinds of things. I don't for one minute believe that Donald Trump actually won the electoral
college. Okay, we'll pick it up, and I'm sorry, guys, but we're out of time there. I apologize. The great conspiracy, the conspiracy, this was bought off. This was, is there a canon?
Not conspiracy theorists.
I don't mean to paint it away like that. Robert Mueller is looking right now at this very issue. Do you see a cannon waiting to go off with the Mueller view, and has there been enough attention paid to the results with this degree of skepticism?
Well, I just want to answer first because I don't want to end on a terrible note. I think the Mueller investigation is going to pan out, but my bigger concern is what happens then. I mean, if there is a move to impeach this president, I think there's a portion of this country that's going to react very badly to it. So that's my
What do you mean by very badly?
We have a lot of people who have conspiracy theories, and they've talked about open revolution. We have a lot of these people who talk about that stuff. So I'm concerned about the consequences of it.
Thank God we don't have a lot of guns in this country. Maureen?
I think about the Mueller investigation that what people forget about Donald Trump is that no one expected him to win, and he was surrounded by a lot of really sleazy people that no one else in politics would have working for them. When I was in Washington in the 80s, the firm of Lee Atwater, Roger Stone, and Paul Manafort was considered the dark one. So, you know, and they were in these sleazy deals with a lot of countries, and then suddenly he's Trump's campaign manager. So I don't know anything about this guy, Carter Page, but, you know, when you turn over the rock on a lot of sleazy people who were attaching themselves to what, in essence, really wasn't a campaign. I went over to see Trump's campaign at the Trump Tower in June before the election. He was heading toward the nomination, and it was like his lawyer, a few scared-looking kids. There were more pictures of Donald Trump than there were campaign workers, which maybe is kind of proving your point. But, you know, these people that attached themselves to this sort of ghost ship had, you know, when you turn that rock over, of course Mueller's going to find a lot. But the question is it going to be you know, did Donald Trump know, or was it just a bunch of sleazy guys doing side deals? You know, I was asking Mark Cuban about this, and he was rolling his eyes going, if there was a refrigerator full of ham and you spotted Donald Trump two pieces of bread, he couldn't collude with a ham sandwich. So it may just have been a lot of sleazeballs, you know, making their own deals, but we'll see. And with Donald Trump, you know, I hate to use Donald Trump and Dickens in the same sentence, but he is another master of cliffhangers. So we can never know where any of this is going.
I'm going to thank you. Well, final question, because you're here and we have now this drumbeat of sexual harassment charges, this spreading kind of array, drawing lots of people into it, including Leanne Wieseltier, who's right in your acknowledgments as a favorite kind of go-to guy for views on the world. Where does that end? I mean, the president, you know, had his Hollywood access Hollywood tapes way back. Now, every day we have more. It seems like it's spreading out. You're a special eye on this. Where does this go? And does it, I don't know, if politics are the destination or not?
Yeah, here's what I think. You know, I did a magazine story a couple years ago about why there are very few female directors in Hollywood. There was 1% of the top 100 grossing movies when I did it. Now it's up to 7. But I think when you have a culture like Hollywood or Saudi Arabia or the Catholic Church, I hate to say my church, that doesn't make full use of the brains and hearts and talent of women, it gets to be a very warped culture. And I think that's what happened to all three of them.
Thank you. We're going to end on that note. Maureen Dowd's book, and she'll have them at the back of the hall, is The Year of Voting Dangerously, The Derangement of American Politics. And Jared Yates Sexton, the people are going to rise like the water on your shore. It's been a wonderful hour. Boston Book Festival, you're great. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.